Ladies and gentlemen, the Haynes Sisters.
Can you imagine Freckleface having sisters as cute as that?
It's incredible.
Sisters, sisters, there were never such devoted sisters. Never had to have a chaperone, no sir. I'm here to keep my eye on her.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Listener Essay.
Hello, and welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Allison, and today I'm going to help you get in touch with your feminine side with a listener essay from Wendy.
My three sisters and I grew up in a family of seven. We all attended the same church meetings, dated nice Mormon boys from the same families, and all got our Young Women in Excellence awards with the accompanying necklace and that little twirling lady statue. Three of us married in the temple and all have kids. My oldest sister is a hippy-dippy, free-thinking, New Order Mormon. Why, the next one is your typical traditional Mormon housewife, and I resigned my membership earlier this year. My little sister went off the rails in high school and has been trying to rebuild her life ever since. We've all landed in drastically different places with our lives and relationship with the church, so what happened? My oldest sister, Tania, was shy and bookish and really pretty. She got a boyfriend in high school and married him after his mission. After they married, she completed her bachelor's degree and started having kids. Her husband has spent the last decade plus in the trenches of academia, but they seem happy and are really fun-loving people. My next oldest sister, Kathy, is what we euphemistically refer to in the church as a sweet spirit. She was talented in music and identified with this talent as a way to overcome the rejection from boys that Tania never seemed to have. She got her degree and returned home unmarried, an old maid at 23. When a nice returned missionary took an interest, she found herself engaged after 2 weeks and married just after 2 months. Now, I'm uncomfortable trying to explain what happened to my youngest sister, Jay. She was 8 years younger than me, and her formative years occurred when I was three states away. And I can say that my parents, who were dutiful and I think tried their hardest, seemed to kind of run out of steam when it came to parenting Jay. Corporal punishment was seldom used in our house growing up, and my parents' favorite way to discipline would be to ground us. Sometimes the length of the punishment would balloon into untenable proportions amidst an argument. "You're grounded for a week," they would yell. "Fine! You want to be smart with me? Now it's a month!" Jay would tread lightly around week two of a punishment, asking for permission to attend some events and hoping that their forgetfulness or lazy enforcement or guilt at such an absurd punishment would give her that permission. Jay was overweight and never fit in with her cohorts at church. The vast majority of them were children from the same core six or seven families that ran the ward. They were all, without exception, thin and blonde and wore fake nails. They were Utah Mormons transplanted into our neck of the woods. And she was 5 years younger than the closest sibling, 13 years younger than the oldest, and it just seemed like my parents had lost the fight in them to care to shape Jay into a productive member of society. She rebelled in a fashion that would alarm even the most progressive and permissive parents, and my sweet mom was just beside herself. While Jay's church attendance was consistent throughout her teenage years, after all, who would want to risk a week of grounding for just a lousy 3 hours of church? Still, her extracurricular behavior was not exactly sacrament-worthy. Jay told my parents that she was not interested in attending church ever again on the day she moved out, and my parents were heartbroken. Jay has since found her way out of that life and has a nice boyfriend and a job, and she is kind and good. Now, for me. Oftentimes, when people have left the church talk about themselves in their TBM days, there's this sort of dick measuring that happens when you're trying to prove at how good at being Mormon you were. The truth is, I did go to church every week, obeyed the word of wisdom, attended a singles ward and all the ancillary events. But to borrow from the vernacular of Mormons, I always felt in the church, but not of the church. I would watch R-rated movies, sometimes with great justification of that choice to anybody who would listen. I listened to music with swear words and was generally pretty irreverent. But I tried to hold to the rod. As an 8-year-old, I cried through my entire baptism ceremony, and I remember once giving an impassioned plea from the pulpit of my singles ward that the men needed to get their shit together and home teach us because we did not have the priesthood in our homes. Oy. When I moved out of state to Washington, my parents always seemed pleasantly surprised that I had remained active. But the truth was, I liked being Mormon. Sure, I was always reluctant to tell anybody that I was. I never gave a coworker a Book of Mormon with my testimony on the cover page. But I liked that I was different from the world around me. I was above this fray, operating on a different frequency than the rest of these drunk layabouts. I had like-minded Mormon friends, which were easy to find in Seattle, the bleeding-heart hipster capital of the Northwest, with apologies to Portland. My friends and I would listen to Jay-Z albums and relish in the novelty of middle-class white kids knowing all the words. I married a guy that I'd known in high school, one of the non-Mormons in my group of friends. He converted once we started dating. I remember I was taking brownies out of the oven in the middle of his first discussion, and I felt my stomach drop when the missionaries, who had known him for all of 15 minutes, asked him if he would commit to be baptized. I was so embarrassed by their tactlessness and their hubris, but I was very surprised when my boyfriend said, in a solemn tone befitting of a future priesthood holder, "Yes, I guess I can have that effect." Before our engagement, he called my dad from out of state to ask for his blessing, and my dad said, "Well, just make sure you take my daughter to the temple. You got it, Pops." We were married and attended the temple a year later to be sealed. Now, I had always fancied myself someone who got it when it came to weird Mormon doctrine. I had heard cautionary tales of girls who had gone to the temple before their wedding at 18, freaked out at how weird it was, and never went back. I promised myself that I wasn't going to be that kind of airhead. I was practically ancient, going through the temple at 25, and I wanted to be open to the esoteric nature of the temple and realize my mortal shortcomings when it came to understanding concepts as huge and important as eternal salvation. I was going to be one of the ones who got it. But I found my temple experience to be equal parts awful and boring. I remember walking out and thinking, how do people bear their testimony in sacrament meeting month after month about the fresh insights they receive every time they attend the temple? It all seemed pretty straightforward to me. A lot of standing and sitting and putting on even more articles of clothing, like the world's least sexy anti-striptease. I was sad and confused by my experience there, especially the prayer circle that I participated in. It felt creepy and culty, even through my belief and desire to understand. My shitty experience led me to doubling down on my defense of the church. I even snapped at a girlfriend who made a lighthearted comment about how silly she thought the men looked in their baker's caps and aprons. Proof that the church is not the same everywhere you go. We may have stayed Mormon forever in Seattle. Our married ward was brimming with people who were single, childless, professional, or all three. There was a richness of discussion in gospel doctrine which always distilled down to two basic tenets: Jesus loves you, and be good to others. One man in our ward was a great example of this. He had lived hard and then converted later in life and married a lovely Mormon gal. He had visible tattoos and an almost complete disregard for cultural propriety within the church. He made it very clear to the bishopric that he would never, under any circumstances, pray or speak in sacrament meeting or teach a lesson. He was always present at service projects and was always the first one to sign up for dinner deliveries. But it seemed like any time there was a new bishopric member or elders' quorum president, they would try to break his resolve and get him to speak or pray or teach, and his response was always a firm, resounding nope. He was the ward mission leader, and unlike the lip service that mission presidents and apostles pay to the idea, he actually did not care at all about numbers. He would chastise the missionaries for trawling less than savory areas for warm bodies to plop into the pews for church meetings. He would call such behavior embarrassing and counterproductive. Needless to say, the missionaries hated him. But he was a rare specimen, someone who saw the church as the alternative to his destructive lifestyle that he'd lived for so many decades, and a pure conduit for kindness and service. His gospel felt true to me. We moved out of state from our liberal outpost to a conservative area inside the Mormon corridor. One of our first signs of disaffection, aside from my awful temple experience, was how deeply embedded in Mormon culture our new ward members seemed to be. One woman in Relief Society bragged that she had thrown out all of the caffeinated sodas in her daughter's house to help her avoid the very appearance of evil. Or the book clubs, where we, a bunch of grown-ass women, only ever read young adult fiction. Because, well, the love stories are great and there just aren't too many swears. These weren't really my people, were they? From there, I dabbled in inactivity, thanks to my job that required me to work most Sundays. When I got pregnant, it became a real shit-or-get-off-the-pot moment. Would my husband be able to bless our baby as we hadn't been attending regularly? Did we want to have him blessed? What if he was gay someday? Is this the life we wanted for him? What would my family say if we didn't bless him? Or worse, what would the ward members say when they saw my dad performing the blessing and not my husband? It's at this point in the story where we end up where most of these stories end up, the internet. It took about an hour on Mormon Think before it was all over. I felt the betrayal that seems to affect so many post-correlation millennials like myself. The facsimiles, the Hoffman affair, the fact that Joseph Smith had 32 wives that were not Emma. They don't tell you about the stages of grief when you exit Mormonism. Apparently, one of my stages was be an asshole to everyone you have ever loved who is Mormon. I had a big fat axe to grind with the church's lack of transparency in important doctrinal matters, and I thought that since I was good and devoted to Mormonism before my newfound knowledge, and I was happy to have finally found it, that my family would be as welcoming of this information as I was. Well, I was wrong. I understand now how missionaries must feel after being dismissed on a doorstep. I have the answer, people. Why won't you listen to me? But I had to learn to let it go. I had to decide if I wanted a relationship with my family built on mutual respect, or if I wanted to be right. So where is Tania? I think the academic world that her family has been in for so long has started to rub off on her. For example, she realized the absurdity of when her brother-in-law came out to his CES-employed parents in the mid-2000s, and the first question from his father was, "So does that mean you have AIDS?" She had worn pants to church a couple of years ago in solidarity with the feminist Mormons, even though she wasn't entirely on board with all of the tenets of their movement. That day, a ward member asked her, "So what? What has happened to you in this ward that's made you feel marginalized?" She told me later, "Well, I didn't really feel marginalized until she asked me that." Tania possesses such a rich mind and some pretty sharp critical thinking skills. We would spend hours on the phone talking about rape culture, feminism, modesty, patriarchy, and a handful of other topics that matter to us. But for her, continued activity in the church provides a net good for her family. Most of her children's friends are Mormon, and pulling them out is something that she doesn't want to do. What's more, the siren call for a cushy private school professorship at a church school is on the horizon, and they don't want to shut that door. I can't tell you where Kathy is on any of this stuff, because we don't talk about it. Anytime it comes up organically, she says, in her affected Relief Society general presidency tone, "It just makes me angry, and I don't want to talk about it because it brings the spirit of contention. I'm sorry, but this conversation is over." I would guess that her nuclear family and unused degree in young adult novels aren't providing the stimulation that she probably craves, but I can't be sure. Though she does seem to derive pleasure from making freezer meals weekly for people in her ward and spending every waking moment being a hyper-scheduled busy mom. And to that I say, do you, sister. So what of our shared experiences growing up? Kathy asked me once during a rare moment about all of the times I felt the spirit. How do I explain those? What I want to tell her about is my extreme calm and joy I felt when I got my resignation letter. And it's true, I could revisit my baptism experience and explain that I was a middle child with very little one-on-one interaction with my parents, about how the emotion of wanting to make them happy and having so many approving eyes on me was overwhelming that day, and that I felt good. I can say that my need to love and be loved is what made me so emotional that day, or I can say it was the spirit confirming my decision. But I don't really want to make a distinction because I don't really think that there is one. I felt a closeness with my family and my community that mattered to me, and I wanted to be a good person so I could keep that feeling. Why parse the semantics and call it the spirit or a thinning of the veil or classic middle child neglect made manifest? It was beautiful and real, and it doesn't matter what I call it because it's all the same thing. I feel so comfortable with my life now that I'm an ex-Mormon. My 28 years in the religion have provided a context and richness to my life that I'm happy that I have. I feel so much better now knowing that I know so little about the world, instead of that insulated sadness that comes with thinking that you know basically everything that needs to be known about the universe, the nature of man, and eternal truth. I don't have it all figured out, and that feels good. I still find myself hoping for a late-night text from Tania saying, "Enough is enough, we are out!" Or maybe one from Kathy that says, "So, how much do you know about the Book of Abraham?" In my dreams, we're all sitting around a table, eating Sunday brunch and maybe drinking coffee and talking about how much better this is than church. Being Mormon was good for me, but being able to learn critical thinking and follow the evidence in all areas of my life is much better. But above all, being able to call any of my sisters and talk about our days, to learn how to love these people, my tribe, despite our ever-widening worldviews, and then being able to end the conversation by saying I love you and mean it. Well, that's the best.
All right. Wendy, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Skype. And I don't know what I'm doing.
Trust me, I'm an engineer. I think we put this thing right here. Trust me, I'm an engineer. What the fuck did just happen here?
Yeah.
By the way, before we start really quick, I just want to give a big high five to all the infants for putting Allison in charge of something and having another girl on after the last one. Thank you very much.
Yay.
Well done. You guys are great.
We love ladies.
I bet you do.
Yes. Very much.
Yeah.
Well, Wendy, I loved your essay. Like, just the way you recorded it, I thought it was really clever.
Yeah, you actually have a really good, and it's probably just natural, so maybe I'm just patting you on the back for something that just comes naturally. I don't know. But you have, like, a really good cadence and a delivery.
Well, thank you.
Reading your essay. It's really good.
I listen to a lot of NPR, so I feel like I can't take all the credit for that.
Yeah, you kind of have an NPR voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's a good fit. That clicked for me.
Yeah.
When you just said it. Just
sometimes I repeat exactly what they're saying as they're saying it and try to match their inflection while I'm driving in the car.
Is that purposefully or is it just like you're just doing it?
No, like I practice when I'm in the car to try to do it because I think it sounds cool. But that's just because I'm bored and driving. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
I used to do that with general authorities.
Yes.
But then I realized I was boring everyone around me. That wasn't working.
Also, if this is confession hour, I also will pause your podcast and respond like I'm on it sometimes while I'm driving.
Oh, I do.
I'm like, fascinating answer question, Glenn. Let me tell you what I think about that. And then I'll go into my diatribe and then I'll start it and then I'll restart it.
That's so much smarter than how I do it. When I'm listening, when I'm not on it, I'll start responding to something stupid ass thing that Glenn says or something. And then I'll just say something over Randy, which is, sometimes Randy or Jake will say exactly what I said.
Right.
So I'm like, oh.
I don't even need to be there.
Yeah, really.
I mean, we're all white males. Like, how different can our perspective really be? So one of us is going to get it. If there are three of us on the podcast, every single thought that we would have, that any of us would have, will be represented at some point, probably.
That's right. That is right.
I can say that because I have gay friends.
So you, in your essay, you talk about your sisters and their different kind of Mormoniness.
We have a very differing level of Mormoniness between all of us. So my oldest sister is like, she just told me she wore pants to church last week because it was really cold, which was awesome. And she also told me that she got her name off the visiting teaching list because she couldn't like deal with that in her life right now, and she felt zero guilt about it, which is crazy and so different than how she was 5 years ago. And then my next oldest sister is super small town, like hyper Mormon. And then there's me, who's like an outed, like militant, happy atheist. And then my little sister, who's like doesn't care about any of it. Like if she never heard the word Mormon again, she'd be happy. Yeah, what can I say?
Okay. I was wondering, what do your parents feel like? How do your parents deal with all of the different levels of your belief? All of you.
Yeah, where are your parents? Are they pretty strict?
Well, so my dad, he made a joke one time. So when we moved when I was 8. So we had a pretty young family at the time. I'm the middle child. We moved when I was 8 to another town, and he was in the bishopric and was an high priest advisor before he left. And then he moved, and he wasn't anything. He went to high priest, and then he got called as a high priest advisor or the group leader for like 4 months, and then joked about how he got fired from it, but we don't really know why. But he would always joke about when we were young how he would never be called to be bishop, so we didn't have anything to worry about. And I never really got that, because he was like totally Mormon, right? Like, he never swore. He most of the time wouldn't let us watch The Simpsons. Like, he was very clear on the rules. But for whatever reason, he was always looked over for leadership positions. But even still, he's still a super great guy. But my mom, she grew up in like a pioneer stock family. And she grew up in a small town, went to BYU, married my dad, and then they have been living together ever since. So she has a much more kind of narrow view of the world because of that. Whereas my dad converted when he was, I think 20 or 21. And so he has a lot more, you know, context for how he lives his life as opposed to my mom. But either way, I mean, they still go to church every week. They're like the baptism coordinators for the stake. So they have people coming over all the time to get baptism clothes out of their spare bedroom. So yeah, they're in it. They're in it to win it for sure.
Is it fair to say that your dad's probably maybe secretly or publicly stated that he's wanted to be a bishop or be in those higher callings?
No, not at all. He's like a super fun guy. Like, he's like the, you know, he's a teacher, but he's a musician. And so he's just very affable and nice and gets along well with everybody.
Sure.
But he's not really very solemn, I think, which is the difference between the people that they called as bishop compared to him. But then again, the people in my family ward growing up, everybody that was a bishop, they were all in the same group of friends. So like, one would get released and then the next one would get called, and it was like his best friend or, you know, second cousin or something. And then the next one would get called and it would be the same person in that same kind of, you know, like the power Mormons within the ward.
Yeah.
So my parents really weren't a part of that. But they still, I mean, they're just as Mormon as you can be. I mean, my mom was like, what about this podcast called Serial? And I was like, you don't want to go there, Mom. They talk about sex. And she's like, oh, okay.
But it's really compelling and good stuff, though.
So I'm guessing they don't deal too well with your disaffection, or?
Well, they did okay. So I talked to my dad about it alone first, and he was fantastic. I mean, he was obviously upset about it, and he was more of a, like what I said in my essay, when I had my son, there was a lot of question as to whether or not we would get him blessed and who would bless him.
Right.
And that was kind of a big area of stress in my life. And so my dad brought it up to me when we were alone. Well, you know, me and the baby, but he can't talk. And I told him that, you know, these were my concerns, and that I was having a faith crisis, and I didn't believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon and all this stuff. And everything I would bring up, like, Joseph Smith had 32 wives, or the Book of Abraham is complete malarkey. The way that he responded to me was this sort of like, yeah, I know, duh. Like, nothing fazed him. When I'm like, bullshit, we have sat through the same classes for 20 years and nobody ever talked about this, you know, like he was very unfazed about it. But when there was another instance where we were talking about something about Joseph Smith, about Rough Stone Rolling, in the car together, and we came home and we had continued our conversation in the house when my mom was there, and she heard us talking and she just lost it, started bawling and saying, I'm so upset that you're making this decision and that you're ruining your chances for eternal progression through this. And no matter what, I'm never going to babysit your kid if you want to go out and drink and party and get drunk, party time USA. And I'm like,
wow.
Oh, so we've evolved a lot since then, but initially it was very difficult for them to kind of get their brain around it, because my little sister left in high school and they could kind of chalk that up to youthful rebellion. But I was 28 when I left, and I was very Mormon my whole life. And so I think it was more of a shock to their system. Like, well, if Wendy can leave, then, you know, nobody's safe.
Your little sister was Jay that you talked about in your essay.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, since she was so much younger than the rest of us, I was never around when she was a kid, or, you know, when she was a adolescent. So I only got information secondhand from my mom, and the way that their relationship panned out, I don't know. But the truth is that she hated going to church. Everybody she went to church with, everybody in her cohort, they were mean girls. They were total bitches. And they looked like Real Housewives. Like, they looked like they were 30 years older than they were, trying to look young, but they were 16. It was nuts.
Oh, wow.
And so it's no wonder she hated it. And so she had this relationship with my parents, and that has definitely informed how they deal, like, talk to her and engage with her now.
I always think it's interesting to hear people's backstory in the context of their upbringing and their parents, because I've found that really can change how people view it themselves, you know?
Right. And I don't feel like, I mean, I think in comparison to other families, we weren't, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but we weren't particularly reverent. Mm-hmm. Like, we weren't like, yeah, there were five of us, but there weren't 12 of us. And we weren't like those people at church, you know, like, we were all like theater kids and kind of like quirky and weird and outgoing. And so,
yeah, you said in your essay you watched R-rated movies.
Yeah, right?
Right, yeah.
I just watched Boogie Nights last night, by the way. Wrecked it. I have a lot of catching up to do in the media realm.
I'm so surprised, though. I'm still a little disoriented when you said that you approached your father so directly, like, oh, the Book of Abraham doesn't, you know, it's essentially fiction and blah, blah, blah. But then your mom was a little more, I don't know, strict or literal, because, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of disorienting to me that your dad, were you really that direct with him? Or was he just kind of like, yeah, you know, it's a really good social thing for people. I don't know.
Well, I mean, very the conversation liberal. Evolved. Like, I mean, that was like the end of the conversation that we'd had over a half an hour or so.
Oh, yeah,
so it
fair enough.
Evolved to that point. But I asked my dad that question, right? Like the two-pronged, if the church wasn't true, would you want to know about it? And then if it wasn't true, would you do anything different in your life? Mm-hmm. And I asked him that question. I was like, okay, Dad, if the church wasn't true, would you want to know about it? And he said, and just let me quote this. He said, I mean, yeah, yeah, yes, yes. He said
the hesitation
like 12 times. And I'm like, you're not super convincing on that.
Right, right. It's like he's amping up to get in a cold shower. He's like, all right. I can do this.
Right. So like he's more approachable in this stuff anyway, because his whole family, he's the only member of the church in his family. And so he has sort of dealt with this kind of, you know, he knows what it's like to deal with people who aren't Mormon all the time and to not love them any less because of it. So I felt like out of the two parents, he was much more approachable for me to be the person that I could kind of engage with on this topic.
That's cool.
Did you feel that that his kind of his unflappability set you up to be a bit of a bull in the china closet with your other siblings that were a little bit more delicate about this type of thing?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, because I had go ahead.
I felt very steeled up by that. Like, he did not like engage in a negative way, or rather he didn't get offended by what I was saying. It was all very straightforward to him. So I thought, okay, well, my sisters don't know any of this stuff. And apparently my dad is like an oracle of Mormonism. So when I tell them, they're going to be so happy that I told them. So yeah, it definitely sealed my resolve to tell my sisters about it.
Yeah. Cause I actually had a similar experience with, I was doing, you know, my little brother Jake thing on the side or as this hobby, but I never told any of my siblings about it. I mean, they knew that I had doubts about church or whatever, but it was all very abstract, nothing really concrete. But then he stumbled across these because some friend at work found him and was like, hey, have you seen this? You're Mormon, right? Have you seen this? And he was like, that's my little brother. and so he contacted me. He's like, why didn't you tell me about this? I mean, he felt very... I guess there was like almost like a disappointment that I had been that I hadn't told him about it, and he was sympathetic to a lot of the issues that I was bringing up. This was like in the earlier videos of Brother Jake when they were still about topics that could be safely kind of satirized without really hitting at the core of anything. So anyway, I took that as a signal of, well, maybe my family, you know, could accept this thing. It's like maybe we don't see eye to eye, but they can see kind of the value in what I'm doing. And anyway, that was a real miscalculation on my part. I sent out this email and it really backfired and was not a good it was kind of a rude awakening for them about my standing with the church. Anyway, I didn't read right. that correctly. So that seems like it almost sounds like what the situation with your dad, and then that kind of snowballing into the way you interacted with the other members of your family and how their reaction was so vastly different than what you had come to expect.
Right. And I think too, especially with hardcore members, is that the church is this thing in their life totally beyond satire and beyond reproach, where it's like you can make fun of the president, even if you kind of like him, you can say that he's a doofus or whatever, but it's like you can't joke in any semi-serious way about the prophet because that's like off limits.
Right.
And that's hard. It's hard to live like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I related to your, when you talked about in your essay, how you kind of had an axe to grind with the church and you took it out on your family.
Totally. Yes.
And I kind of didn't realize this, but I think I did that same thing, but with my friends. And I had always sort of thought, well, like my friends just ditched me because I wasn't Mormon anymore. But looking back on it, like I made some major, major faux pas. It's like socially regarding how I approached the topic of the church with my really good Mormon friends. And I think I did that because I was so pissed off. And I didn't have a family to do it with because I'm a convert. But I was listening to your essay and I was like, oh my God, I think that's what I did.
Yeah. Well, I had friends too, like about a year and a half ago. That was right when my disaffection was at its peak. I had some friends that were in the Peace Corps and they had come back. And they obviously hadn't been attending church super regularly because they were in Africa. And I had just found this letter to a CES director and I had totally pored over that, read the whole thing. And I kind of made this shitty ultimatum to them. Like, we cannot talk about the church until you read this in its entirety. Mm. Like I was such a bitch about it, but I was so zealous about it. And you know, I mean, if you want to, you can blame the fact that I'm like a shitty, aggressive person, or you can blame the fact that I was like a totally great Mormon, which are the same thing, basically. Like I had no boundaries about my belief system and about the belief system of others. And so I wasn't able to like properly introduce how I believe, like what I believed, because I didn't know how. Like I thought this is what you do. You have a torch to bear. You have something very important to you and the world needs to know about it, which is the way that Mormons view missionary work, every member of missionary stuff. And so I didn't have good tools in my toolbox to figure out how to engage with people that were still believing in a way that was non-threatening and that was loving and that was kind. Cause that wasn't my goal. My goal was conversion.
Right. I feel like I did the same thing. That really resonates with me. What you said, Allison, and what you said, Wendy, about, interacting with everybody in this aggressive way at the beginning. And it really does feed this kind of ex-Mormon persecution complex that I think we can have a lot of times where it's like, well, everybody's just rejecting me. It's like, yeah, because you're shitting all over everybody's worldview that you know and love, you know? It's like, and in a way, it's like when you scream at the person on customer service for, you know, Comcast or whatever. You hate the institution and you want to get back at the institution. So you just focus all of this vitriol on this one guy in India or whatever.
He's making
me. And you're like, hook up my goddamn modem. Come on. And it's just really, they're totally, they're as disconnected as any two things could be. And it's just, I don't know. It's a tough period of time. It's like a second adolescence.
Exactly.
Yeah, learning curve for sure. And then you see other you know, people leave the church and you see them do the same thing and you want to tell them like, no, stop.
But, right.
Well, in the ex-Mormon community, you guys have probably seen this where, you know, a lot of fresh ex-Mormons will go to the LDS Mormon chat.
Oh, right.
And they'll find just missionaries, and then they'll just unleash the hounds of hell on them, you know?
Right.
And I always cringe, but part of me is like, yeah, I get it.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's like any adolescent indiscretion. You're like, yeah, I've been there. I get that. I see why you're doing that.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Wendy, I have a question about your husband. Do you – did he join the church for you, or do you think he was really buying those missionary discussions?
That's a good question. My vanity wants to say that it was because I was like a sweet piece of ass that he really wanted to get in on. And so he,
sure.
He would say the same.
But I think, he has said this before, like the weirdness of the church and kind of this like unattainability of full and complete knowledge of the universe has always been very interesting to him. Like he was a total, and he is a total space nerd. Like his whole Facebook feed is just like SpaceX posts and like Tesla and like interesting space shit that really nobody else is like super into except for him. But so I really do think that the church's like weirdness and like, yeah, their weirdness was Kolob. Really,
it was
yeah, Kolob issue was very exciting to him and was like, and like he had almost been inducted into Masonry because another girlfriend's dad was in it and there was some talk of that. And so like that, like
whole, he's like a serial converter.
Like Illuminati secret society stuff. Like if you were to put a gun to his head, he would tell you that that stuff is super interesting to him. And so really like what is the church except for like a really successful conspiracy theory, you know? So I think he was into that.
That's awesome.
Love it.
Is he out now too, or was he ever really both feet in?
So we left together, and I blame my Mormonism for our lack of communication about it, because I learned from my parents that we never talk about uncomfortable things ever. And so we had not been going to church for months and months because I was working on Sundays, which was helpful. But even then, we didn't really go very often. And so I would joke about being inactive, like, well, cause you know, we're totally inactive now. Like we're going to start getting cookies on our doorstep, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that was like, by joking about it was the way that I could actually talk about it. And so then finally, after like 6 or 8 months of kind of joking about it or being like, I read this thing online about Joseph Smith. Let's talk about that. That we were finally like, we had this discussion together where we're like, I don't really think that this is true. And he's like, me neither. This is fantastic. And then it was just like fantastic from there on. From
oh, I'm so jealous. That is awesome. Oh yeah, I'm
and
jealous.
It's funny
right,
too,
that Beach Boys song came on. Wouldn't it be nice and right? sweet? And then there's like church leaving montage.
Wouldn't it be nice if we were old?
Drinking and shooting up heroin or whatever.
Right. Then it goes a little too far, like you wreck a car and kill a hooker right. or something, and then like right. you're like, we never talk about this, and then the montage ends.
This never happened.
And then after we talked about it that one time, we were like, oh my God, I've been feeling like this for months. And he's like, me too. And then we get to finally air that out. But it's like that sort of like repression of I don't want to say independent thought, but that sort of repression of like going against the authority is so deep seated in me that even like my most trusted person that I'm pretty sure if I said I wasn't into the church anymore, he would agree with me because he hated church and he hadn't been in 6 months. I still couldn't bring myself to say that, you know?
Yeah. Well, cause you don't, it's just hard cause and you see so many other marriages around like, I don't know if you do, but I have, where they just crumble when somebody decides to leave or decides to be honest about it. And
right.
That can be scary.
I told a friend of mine actually this last week, her husband had left the church like 5 years ago, basically right after they got married. And she was a convert and she was like the most Mormon convert I've ever met in my life. And so she went to church every week without him. She was like super into it. And I remember a conversation I had with her where she was talking about how they were moving apartments and he had booze in the house. And she's like, I am not moving into this new apartment with you if you have alcohol in our house. And there was this big ultimatum, yada, yada. She's telling me all about their marital issues around the church. And I told her, me, ex-Mormon, Wendy, told her, you got to divorce that guy. That guy's bad news. And like I told her that that is one of my top five regrets in life is being the type of person that couldn't see that like their compatibility otherwise, like that the church doesn't matter when it comes to like overall compatibility and being nice to each other and enjoying each other's company and being good providers for each other, yada, yada, yada. But I was that deep into it that I was like, you got to divorce that guy. He can't take you to the celestial kingdom. So peace out, dude.
Yeah, I've been there too. I've said shit like that to people and blocked it out of my memory.
I had blocked it out of memory too. Another friend of mine told me, she said, I remember one time in our singles ward up in Seattle, you went on this big long diatribe about how like we live in a super liberal area and we all think we should be okay with homosexuality, but that it's totally not okay. And that like we shouldn't pretend and joke and like think that it's okay because it's not. And I'm like, I said that. That's crazy. I'm like the leftist, most hippy dippy person in my family. And I was at a point in my life where I totally thought that gay people were gross.
Let's stop pretending like we accept
them. I know.
That's such a wow.
So all you liberal would-be New Order Mormon bullshit, you all know the gayness is super bad and gross. I was like, that's terrible.
Wow. Yeah.
This kind of brings up something that I wanted to talk to you about is that humbling experience of becoming an ex-Mormon that I think, well, happened to me, but I got the sense from your essay that you were like, okay, I get it now. I'm not, my shit does stink and I've been wrong.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's very hard.
That happens to a lot of people. And I think some of them unfortunately don't see it in the way that they've been humbled, just that they were wrong, but they don't let it really humble them. And I hate saying that like, cause it's such a churchy term. Oh, I've been humbled, right. But I mean it in a really sincere way that as a Mormon, I was pretty damn, like, I knew it. I knew it was true and everybody else was wrong.
Right.
And I felt like I changed as a person by becoming more humble about that I didn't know. And I still don't know. And I think that's it's been good for me.
Right. I think that one of the troubles with living your whole life with Mormonism as your main focus is that you have this, you live in absolutes or you think in absolutes. And so then once you get into ex-Mormon territory, nothing is absolute and you're not really sure of anything. And so the only thing you're sure of is that the church totally sucks. And so you go after the church with the same zeal and joy and like hard work ethic that you went at like converting people to Mormonism. And it's Mormonism sucks for the same reason, is that it's a dangerous way to live your life, is this idea that no matter what anybody else says around you, you have it figured out. Like all those poor plebes who think they know what's going on, like you're the one who gets it. And that's, I mean, it's really just an extension of that same mindset. Mm-hmm. And then getting to the point where you're like, I don't really know anything. Like my area of expertise in the world is so small compared to other people and compared to, you know, the world around me, that it's not fair for me to state absolute knowledge in anything because I don't know. And that's definitely a hard pill to swallow, to eat that shit and be like, yep, I don't know anything. I kind of suck, but everybody sucks, but I kind of suck too.
Yeah. Well, when I started entering into the disbelief world, I took that mental gymnastics of absolutes with me, mm-hmm. thinking that there's still right and wrong and yes and no and up and down, and things just weren't fitting in those boxes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me probably 2 years when I started to really deconstruct it. I think one of the elements for me to really break that down was examining homosexuality or even sexuality in humans. That it's a scale. That just blew my mind. Like, really? So there's not just male and female and straight. That's it. There's like all kinds of things in between. It didn't make any sense to me, and it took me a long time to finally accept, okay, there's just more than just these things that I've been fed this whole time.
Or that there's a God who really gives a lot of shits about all of that stuff. Like, there's a God
who
cares about heterosexuality but is really opposed to homosexuality, or like, you know, intersex issues or gender dysmorphia or cisgender, like all that stuff. God just doesn't want to deal with. Heterosexual is the only way to go, full stop.
But see, when you talk about, Wendy, when you talk about how, I think it was you just said that being Mormon sucked or Mormonism sucks. But like you found this way, it seems like, of looking back on your experience that I think is really, can be kind of rare and lovely, that you don't hate it and you see it for like the good that it did. And or at least that's what you talk about in your essay, right? That you,
right. Yeah.
You don't think about like, well, that was just the spirit, but wait, it wasn't the spirit. So what was it? Oh, it was all bullshit. Like, no, it was special and it mattered.
Right. And you know, I mean, you think about like, so when I was in my 20s, right, I spent 7 years in Seattle and I was in a singles ward for most of that time. And like when you're in your 20s and everybody's single and everybody's trying to be cool, like you do everything you can to be awesome. And so for me, I learned how to play the accordion. I mean, come on.
Wow, that is awesome.
Okay, I think that that's actually super cool. So
see? Mission accomplished. See how cool I am?
You're right up there with Weird Al.
Yeah, that's right? Awesome. But like stuff like that, like you want to, like I wanted so badly to be interesting and quirky and fascinating to somebody, right? Like that's because the whole point of everything is to get married and have a family. And so like my Mormonism was totally a part of that identity. Like I'm totally Mormon, but I'm so cool. Isn't that weird? Like that was a big part of it. And so being like letting go of that, like dismantling that part of my personality kind of left me with this like, okay, so who am I? Like, you know, in my 100-word biography, who am I? What am I interested in? What do I stand for? Like that became less clear and less murky. And so, you know, saying like, I used to be Mormon and now I'm not, it's kind of a way to kind of appropriate that identity without having to deal with all the emotional baggage of being Mormon, of like, I was Mormon and I was a virgin when I got married. And luckily for me, that worked out very well because my husband's awesome, but like it could have been really shitty, but you know, like stuff
so
like
it's
that.
Like it's like a leading disclaimer when you like explain your life. It's like when people lead with like, oh, I had polio as a kid or something like that. It's like, that's why I'm so warped and weird.
Well, it's funny too, because the doors that it opens up, because I'm not as emotional about my ex-Mormonism as I was a year or a year and a half ago. But I'll mention it in passing. Like I work at a facility with senior citizens, and I said something about being a former Mormon, and this woman I was with said, "Oh, are you familiar with Fawn Brody?" And I was like, "Duh, she changed my life." And it ended up she had been friends with her in the 50s and 60s or 50s. Like she worked with her husband, and they were like dinner companions, right? And like stuff like that, which is really small, but like I felt like Mormonism gave me this community to live in and to thrive in, but ex-Mormonism gives it to me too, just in a different way.
What do you guys, so the reason that I asked Tom and Jake on with your essay, Wendy, was because they are both kind of living in this world with people who are really close to them who are either NOM or full-on members, or so I kind of wanted to like explore some of that. And I don't know, what do you guys think? Are you willing?
Yeah. I mean, as much as it would be deemed helpful, that
I'm in.
So what do you guys think are like your top three tips? Let's start out in a really dorky, annoying place. Like your tips for dealing with, like, if you're one of those people that is living in that kind of situation, which can be probably difficult sometimes.
Right.
I've got two. Can I start with two?
Please.
Okay. So one thing that I've noticed is like people who leave Mormonism, like me, when I first started, have this total axe to grind. But I think another issue is people who blame their Mormon upbringing or their Mormon experience for either past or present really shitty behavior. Like, that's a really big problem for me is in the ex-Mormon community, this kind of idea like, oh, well, I was Mormon and I didn't know any better, so that's why I was an asshole. When it's like, no, you were probably just an asshole to begin with.
Right.
Well, yeah, because they don't want to take responsibility for being an asshole. Right.
You know? Like a good example, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but there's this blogger that I kind of half follow. She left Mormonism in a very dramatic fashion and is now like exploring her ex-Mormonism. And she posted this picture on Instagram of her two children playing with her vibrator.
Ooh.
Right? And so, like, everything, every comment on it was like, pretty sure you shouldn't post that shit on Instagram. Your children are going to be adults someday, and their friends are going to make fun of them for that. You should not do that. Plus, it's like, there can be, like, predatory issues. Like, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
And she was so, like, resistant to correction, right? So I think with ex-Mormons, like, the pendulum of righteousness swings so far in the other direction that like you totally lose, people can lose sight of like personal boundaries and social grace and like understanding the feelings and be empathetic of other people. So I think that's one thing to be really careful of is like not to be so like in your face ex-Mormon, because the reason Mormons are annoying to their neighbors is because they're so in your face Mormon. Like, don't be that guy, you know?
Yeah.
Those are good. Yeah, that's true. I don't think I ever went that far, but I had some moments. Internet history, gotta delete. No, that didn't come out right.
That's not what you meant.
Come on. Private browsing. Private browsing.
We could talk about that too. How, like, my husband and I had been out of the church for a whole year before we ever even broached the concept of masturbation. And even then, it was over text because I was too uncomfortable talking about it. it's still, like, that sex shame is so deep that I can't even bring myself to, like, discuss it with my totally supportive, lovely ex-Mormon spouse. It's crazy.
Well, it's understandable to me. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Did you, Wendy, did you go to, I'll go back to Allison's question in a second, but I want to ask this real quick. Did you use any support systems? Like, did you go to online ex-Mormon communities, or did you and your husband kind of already have friends that weren't Mormons already kind of built in? How did you deal with that?
Well, yeah. So I was on exmormon.org like every single day. Until there was a moment where I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I stopped listening all the way. Actually, incidentally, I'm pretty sure it was when you guys had Tom Phillips on, because it was posted all over the ex-Mormon boards. And I was totally into his whole trial hearing stuff. And then I heard your guys' episode and I was like, this is my jam. Like, I don't want people who are too angry, just like a little bit annoyed with the church. Like, this is where I'm more comfortable, you know? But beyond that, we really had... There was one person that was a really very, very good friend of mine who left Mormonism when I was in my early 20s. And I was very, like, it really affected me in a really big way. I stopped being his friend. I had to go home from work that day that he told me because I was crying too much. I mean, it affected me in a really big way. And one of my biggest things, like a 12-step style, after I decided the church wasn't true, was trying to make amends for that, to be like, I am so sorry I stopped being your friend because you weren't Mormon. That was a really dick move, you know? Mm-hmm. But other than that, really, almost all of our friends were still in the church. And so it's been very interesting seeing our main group of kind of single friends who we all kind of intermarried and we all stay in touch. Almost every single person has left the church except for one holdout out of like 11 or 12 of us.
Wow.
So that's been fantastic. It feels like, I mean, it's totally great. And like every time I talk to one of them who is, you know, having a faith crisis, who is interested in leaving, like all I can do is just be like, keep it cool, Wendy. Don't go crazy. Just let it happen. You know?
Right. And I think that's so important for anybody that's going through a transition, is having some sort of support group. I would prefer everybody have like a close friend that, you know, is in that level of trust that you can really unload a lot of these things. And obviously I'd recommend therapy if you're called to do that. But, you know, going back to your original question, Allison, about, you know, what do you do if one partner in the marriage is going through the transition and the other one's staying, it's really tough for me because it felt very traumatic. In a lot of ways, hearing what Wendy and her husband went through isn't quite as similar as mine, because mine felt just too traumatized. Like, I took it way too serious. I was too deeply rooted. And so when the rug got pulled out from under me, my whole world got disoriented. And then my wife was still plugged in, and she still is plugged in. Not as much as she was, but she still is plugged in. And so my world was really shaken up, and I couldn't... The only word that's coming to my mind is trauma. Mm-hmm. And that's why I went to therapy. That's why I sought out podcasts and the ex-Mormon groups, and I was just reaching for straws, anything that I could grasp to help get me stabilized again. And I was so selfish at the time and so consumed with my own needs to try to get my feet back under me. And I kind of forgot about her in the whole situation. And then it took me several months before I finally felt stable enough that I said, okay, let's focus on you, because she was dealing with her own stuff, you know, seeing her husband. I can't remember if I'd mentioned this in a prior podcast, forgive me if I had, but there was one time I was going through all my shit and I came home and my wife didn't expect me at the time, and she was holding our Salt Lake Temple the painting that was on the wall. She was holding it and crying. She's kind of rocking back and forth on the floor.
Oh, God.
And it was at that moment that I just kind of dropped, and I just thought, I don't know. It's just so hard.
Yeah.
I just crumbled, and I thought, I love her, and I don't want this to come between us, but it is. It's in between us. It's all these fibers are wrapped up into me, wrapped up into her, and there's just too much involved. And anyway, I guess I would say, if you're going through this, make sure that you find a way to be stable. Find friends, find support groups, find therapy, whatever it is. But don't forget about your partner as well, because they're going through stuff too. It's a very, very difficult balance. There's no easy solution, because everyone's situations and conditions are different. But anyway.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Tom. Like, that, I'm a huge romantic sap, and I tend to present a little bit rough on the outside, but I am like just the biggest believer in love. And it's like to the point that it's dorky, right? Like, I will sing show tunes about love. I just love, love you guys. when I see marriages break up or relationships break up because of a believing spouse and a non-believing spouse, it hurts me. And especially, I've seen this so much recently, where people who are ex-Mormon telling fellow ex-Mormons who are struggling with, you know, dealing with, I don't want to say dealing with a believing spouse, but just being in that position that's difficult, to just leave or like get a divorce because it's never going to get better. And it's just, that kills me. Like, don't just jump to that. Don't let the church ruin something because you don't know how it's going to turn out. And you can find a way to, you know, make it work. Hopefully you can try. And it's the same thing like Wendy was saying earlier, like where she said to her friend, you got to leave that guy because he's an ex-Mormon. It's just the same thing, but it's flipped the other way, right?
Right. We're all so mad at the church for being involved in our sex lives and our marriage, when like ex-Mormons who do that are doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's just extreme. And it makes me sad when I see that. it can get better. Or like Tom, it seems like, you know, you've found a way to kind of make it work. And I think your advice for getting some kind of community is great. I wish that I would have had that, even though I wasn't in a mixed faith relationship. Just even leaving the church is, like you said, is traumatic. And I don't feel like I really had that support that I needed. I don't know that I think like therapy is the answer, because I almost tend to think sometimes when people just get on this venting jag that it doesn't necessarily help things either. And that can be a little bit counterproductive to just keep you angry. You know, you've got to find a way to move on.
It can, but it also is a healthy mechanism just to get things off your chest. I remember the first time I went to therapy, and it was the first time that I actually felt safe in saying out loud that I didn't believe the church was true. That was the first time I actually vocalized it. And I actually asked my therapist, this is confidential, right? Like, you're not going to go tell anybody, right? Yeah. It's not going to go anywhere. And that's when I said it. And I remember leaving that session thinking, oh my gosh, that was so worth it. I mean, it just like this burden, emotional burden came off my shoulders. But
well, I talked to my oldest sister, Tania, the kind of New Order Mormon. I actually talked to her this week about the last happiness episode you had, and about the idea that, like, you know, I've left Mormonism, but I don't know that I'm net happier than I was before. And she told me, like, this is the trouble with being a part of the feminist Mormon housewives and the ordained women movement, is that women who post and say, you know, I had to leave the church to find my happiness and to follow my truth and to live authentically. But this idea that for her, she said she doesn't know what authenticity or true happiness really is. And so she doesn't know that she doesn't have it now. And so just leaving the church just to, you know, check it out and to make sure, and these bold declarations that what I was doing before was wrong, but what I'm doing now is really right, kind of does a disservice to people who are still in it and trying to make it work within the confines of, you know, their reality, in that they feel like they, you know, the subtext is, I've left the church and I'm living authentically, which means you're still in the church and you are living inauthentically.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And I think, yeah. And I that reminds me of the last part of your essay, which I really liked a lot. The part where you said, you know, I could reinterpret these experiences, but I don't want to because they were real. Like, it doesn't matter if I think we kind of I have in the past kind of entered this fallacy of thinking that just because I don't believe that a certain experience is actually, you know, corresponds to something metaphysical or something true, you know, some larger truth within the universe, then it's not real, or that somehow it's less important or carries less weight for me personally or for the people going through it. I mean, it's just, it's important to recognize that those feelings that you feel are real, no matter whether or not they were about something that is, you know, technically that isn't very empirically sound, you know. They have intrinsic value outside of what you think that they signify.
Right. And if you think about the ex-Mormon view of, like, you, the important thing is connecting with others, being a good person, like the kind of humanist view of the world, treating other people well, like those spiritual experiences you had, like, you know, important social experiences as a Mormon, like those can't be discounted because you were Mormon, because from the humanist perspective, like, they were helping frame you into a better person, into a more caring, more empathetic person. And all that stuff matters.
Right, right, exactly.
Wow. This is so deep. This is kind of cool, actually. I'm liking where this has gone.
Well, and I'm learning something, yeah. And I learned something from listening to your essay, Wendy, because I'm kind of feel like I'm digging myself out of it, but I still deal with a lot of regret. Like, I think I've stated for the record that I look at my mission with regret. I wish I didn't, because I feel like I could have learned the lessons that I learned from my mission in other places that would have been more productive and less culty. But I don't know. It's that's one of the things that I love about your essay and what we're saying here is if I can, I guess I'm talking myself through it right now. If I can find a way to just honor those experiences for what they are and not try to discredit them or even unconsciously discredit it, because that's what I feel like. I feel like there's so much baggage, there's so much negativity that I should probably just dismiss the whole thing. And then I'm just cringing all the time. Like, oh, I hated how I handled that. I hated what happened to me here. I hated that I actually thought that that was, you know, the spirit talking to me and telling me to do something. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think too, like, I mean, you're everything that you regret. I mean, the idea of regret is like, you could have been doing something better, right? Like, think about it. Like, you were 8, you were 19 and 20. Like, you could have been in a frat house totally drunk for 2 years of your life too, you know, like,
true.
So like the idea that like you weren't doing, like what you were doing wasn't valid or wasn't important. It's like, if anything, like you learned how to live on a schedule. God knows I don't know how to do that. And, you know, like there's plenty of things like you learn how to like address people in public. I mean, granted you were telling them malarkey, but you learned how to like approach people in a friendly and an approachable way. I mean, there are plenty of things like that. You learned how to get along with people in close quarters that you otherwise would never speak to in your life.
I learned how to deal with rejection.
Right. Exactly. So like I see benefits to the mission too. But on the other hand, I see like my sister Tania has a son who's, you know, like prepubescent. And that's one of my big questions to her is like, what if this guy doesn't want to go on a mission? Like, what are you going to do? Is it going to be the same like fear and shame cycle that all of our cohorts went through when they did or didn't go on a mission? Or are you going to be like, you can go if you want, but NBD if you don't go, you know?
And I think one of the things that I actually found kind of freeing about letting go of the idea of a morality that's based in the idea of sin is something that there were a lot of I know a lot of people that felt kind of felt a sense of loss at kind of letting go of the idea of the atonement and that type of thing. But honestly, on the flip side of that, I found it actually rather freeing because the subtext of the atonement is that your mistakes stay with you forever unless you get them scrubbed away in this very specific way.
Yep.
And if you can move beyond that and just say, the things that have happened, and there is no going back. There is no reset. There is no perfect version of myself that I can become or like level up to or whatever, you know, once I get to the highest, you know, once I pass all the big boss fights, once I beat Bowser, I can't like level up to the, you know, there's actually kind of a Zen, idea in that where you can just accept things as they are.
Right. Like not to sound like a drunk, like Alcoholics Anonymous style, but like nothing you can do can undo what you did before. So you can either like be pissed off about it. You can be depressed about it, or you can like take whatever tiny morsel of shit, of good shit out of it and like move on with that.
And I think that's important to building empathy with people that are still in the church, because if you can forgive yourself for having done the things, the shitty things, been homophobic, been an asshole, been self-righteous, if you can forgive yourself for those things, then it seems like you're going to have a lot more empathy for when you see that behavior in your still believing friends and family and not necessarily condemn them for that.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, a good example of that is my Peace Corps friends I talked about earlier. His mom is a total, like the most Mormon mom I've ever met in my whole life. I told him I would refer to her as Super Spirit, just in case I talked about her. Mm-hmm. So the Super Spirit, everything is about the church. Like no matter what you're talking about, she finds a way to like edge the conversation back into, you know, this great Mormon Tabernacle Choir version of that song she heard or whatever. Right. I mean, everything's Mormonism for her. And so for her, it's like, you're around her and you are so annoyed and frustrated. Like, lady, can you figure out another interest in life? Or is there anything else in the world that is interesting to you other than like, you know, the type of tie that Thomas S. Monson wore at last conference? But for her, it's like where empathy comes into that is that it's like, she doesn't know any better, and she can't know any better. Like, in her mindset, in her belief system, this is the best that she can do. You know, like, this is all she can do to be as good of a person as she can be. And even though her version of a good person is so wrong and shitty to me, like, she's doing her best.
Mm. Right, right.
Like you said, though, it's hard to remember that when you're just angry. It's tough. It's just all around a crappy, can be crappy.
And let's acknowledge that ex-Mormons have every right to be angry. I mean, you have every right to be angry. Sure. It's just you don't have anything, you don't have anyone, it's hard to really have anyone to be justifiably angry at because those people are dead. That's why it's a religion and not a cult.
The call center in India. Like, don't.
Right. Exactly.
Right. They're just trying to make their money and go home.
Right.
It's true. I mean, I think for me, it's more of a self-preservation thing where it's like, because I have always been very close to my family and we all get along pretty well. Like, my way of coping with our differences and my way of engaging with them in like a loving, non-threatening way is to back down. Like, I'm willing to give a little bit and to meet them in the middle there. Whereas, you know, people who are zealots on either side of it, super zealot Mormons or super zealous not ex-Mormons, like they're closing themselves off from relationships that might otherwise be very, you know, edifying and important to them that they won't be able to have if they don't open themselves up to that.
Yeah, and I think that's important. There's obviously zealots on both sides. And I had a friend that just the other day, and he's been with me through this entire journey of mine. And there's been rough spots where we didn't talk for a while, and the church stuff has been an issue. But he let slip, and these are the moments of authenticity that always slip out, is he says, what was he talking about? He's talking about someone in his family and that they were going through issues and they were going to leave the church. And then he just said, kind of nonchalantly said, he took the church too seriously like you did. and I kind of sat back.
It any other way, like, right? That's the name of the game.
and I was like seriously offended. Like, wait, what? Well, can't I say that you're not taking it seriously? You know, I was kind of offended, but at the same time, it was just this, you know, lights going on in the room kind of moment for me. Anyway,
and the more zealous and like over the top and annoying of an ex-Mormon you are, the less accessible you are to people who are maybe having a faith crisis. Like, if you're going to go and be in their face about how shitty Mormonism is, and they're not totally on board with that sentiment, they're not going to want to engage with you. Whereas if you are somebody who like can keep it together and keep it cool for a little while, then that allows them to open up a little bit. And then you can kind of discuss with them in like a rational, sensible manner and these things that otherwise they might have nobody to talk to about, or they would talk to their bishop about it, you know?
Yeah, I have some pretty deep regret about with how I treated my friendships, because I wonder about that. Like, how many of those people would have come to me with their issues if I hadn't been such a jerk? Because I know they have issues. Everybody does, right? Everybody has a shelf. So, and not like, I know they never ever will, because they don't want to be like me. They don't want to be like how I was. And that just sucks. And they're not my friends anymore. Well, <Aww. laughs> also they won't come. Well, I have new friends, guys. It's
okay. Yay.
Yeah. Friends are disposable.
there's this kind of like, I feel like a sort of obligation to my Mormon friends to be the kind of person that can have empathy for their situation. Because like I said, like 7 or 8 or 10 years ago, I was standing up in Sunday school talking about how terrible it is to be gay. So like, I've been there, so I know it. And so like, to let my shame allow me to turn my back on that whole existence does a disservice to everybody, including them, in that I'm not able to, you know, meet them in the middle and see where they're coming from.
Yeah, I think that's really key. I mean, I had this moment where I was talking to a friend of mine who is gay. and I told him, you know, I was getting real vulnerable and I told him how homophobic I was. And I had like this like nagging shame and embarrassment about it. Like I hated guys like you, people that, you know, chose their own sex, like, ugh. And I was explaining this to him and he's like, Tom, but look at where you're at now. I mean, we're good friends now.
Right.
You stop worrying about what you were and look at the change that's happened now. You're an ally. How many straight guy friends do I have right now that are very accepting of me in Utah Valley? Hardly any. And it was like this moment where I'm like, yeah, you're right. You know, I was a homophobic guy, but you know, I've turned around, dude.
Right.
I just, in that same vein, like the fact that I was a super Mormon through high school totally shielded me from really irrational adolescent decision making that I may have otherwise engaged in, like really bad behavior that I'm really glad in retrospect I didn't do. Like, I'm glad I didn't have a drink until I was 28. I'm glad that I didn't like be in a position where there would be like, you know, like illicit drugs, where I could have been arrested, where there would have been a date rape situation. Like, there are lots of really great things about being totally like straight all through high school that I'm grateful for now, that I don't have to deal with the repercussions of that later. Because, you know, once you're an adult and you're mature and you realize how shitty that behavior can be, it's too late. You've already done it. And so I'm glad for that I was able to avoid so much heartache and stress. And I mean, I still had heartache and stress from being Mormon, but I don't know that it would compare really if there was something really terrible that had happened to me, you know?
Glass half full. I love it. You're absolutely right.
Right.
For sure. But yes, I do think that the whole dick measuring of ex-Mormons is really exhausting to me, because this idea that like you have to somehow prove how good at Mormonism you were in order to feel the same level of like stress and frustration and rejection when you find out that it's wrong. I think that sucks, because I think Mormonism by nature is totally all encompassing. So if you're a great Mormon for a year or for 20 years, it still totally took up your whole life for that whole amount of time, you know?
And you're, I mean, through in 1 year, you're exposed to all the information that somebody's exposed to in 20, because they recycle all the manuals and stuff. Like in, yeah. Well, I guess not 1 year, but if you're Mormon, if you attend for 4 years, yeah. Mm-hmm. You're exposed to every single lesson that anybody going for 20 years has been exposed to.
Yeah. Well, and so, I talked into this thing recently where I've seen people make comments like online, different forums and stuff where it's like, how could anybody be a convert? How could anybody join the church? And like, what is with those stupid people? And I'm like, wait a minute.
Right.
I mean, it's the same thing. Like anything that you have in your life that you have changed your mind on, you can't understand. Well, people who are shitty can't understand how anybody could have ever thought that, when it's like, a lot of people think that. It's like being liberal and being like, I don't understand how you can be for gun rights. Look at all the gun violence. When it's like, well, like 48% of the country is in favor of gun rights. So like, having that sort of dismissive attitude is detrimental to your ability to like understand and engage and discuss it with people, you know?
Right.
You know, it's interesting going back to the whole credibility thing in the ex-Mormon circles. I think part of it is in the Mormon community as well, because my stake president, I might edit this out, I don't know, we'll see. My stake president says to me that he wouldn't be spending so much time and working with me on a, you know, semi-regular basis right now if I hadn't been in leadership positions. So like if I was just a primary teacher or, you know, working in nursery or whatever, then I guess he wouldn't, that's just not worth his time. And because I was on the High Council and we worked pretty exclusively together, he feels like, you know, Tom's a responsibility for me. I need to work with him because, you know, he was really high up that tree and, you know, and I need to work with him.
Yeah.
And in some ways I think, yeah, but But like you said, Wendy, still people like Heather from Mormon Expositor, she didn't go up any ranks or anything, but her experience in Mormonism was extremely traumatic, probably more so than mine in some ways. So anyway.
Well, it's like my dad joking about how he would never become a bishop. Like now, as an ex-Mormon, I'm like, I would have rather died than have my dad be a bishop and ask me if I was having inappropriate sexual contact with people when I was 14, right?
Right. But
still, as an ex-Mormon, on the other side of it, I'm like, you know what, guys? Fuck you for not choosing my dad.
Right.
I knew you guys were wrong.
Right.
But the
You're
thing is, that's
everything.
That's absolutely something that every male in the church aspires to. Even if it's like secretly in their secret in those moments when they, you know, they admit it to themselves, they.
Do you think it's just a power thing or like why?
We
like more than just our dick stroke. We like our ego stroke.
Right,
if you will.
Right, exactly. But I mean, it's the premier like validation structure within the church for males is the. I mean, that's why you call your bishop bishop. You don't call him Carl. You call – and your stake president. Does anyone call a Relief Society president president?
No. Fuck no.
No. No. They call her
they
Karen.
Should, but,
right?
Yeah,
or Sister Campbell
Smith,
or whatever. Yeah. But no, the leadership – the priesthood leadership structure, there's this like – there's this very clear deference to them. They sit up on the stand. They watch people go around. They don't have to go a bunch of boring-ass – meetings all I mean they go to boring meetings, but they don't have to go to Sunday school. They disappear to secret places. And
yeah, where do they go?
Yeah, exactly. That's, I don't know. I never got to be one. So but it's something we all aspire to in some at some level, because it's like the way that people are validated. It's
the sacrament first.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Hope that it's not poisoned so they don't die. Isn't that why? I heard.
I know, so they should have the deacons taste it first just to make sure. Because we could lose them. It doesn't matter.
It's true. 12-year-old boys are totally useless.
Right.
isn't the stand just a perfect, you know, symbol of what's going on? Because I remember all the times I would sit up on the stand, you're elevated, literally elevated over the congregation. They're all looking at you. You're looking literally down at them. Ugh, I don't know. It gives me, you know, douche chills when I think about it now.
That was one of my big, like, ex-Mormon fantasies of, like, I wish that I could have gone back before I told everybody and their dog that I was leaving the church, that I could have, like, just gone one Sunday and just sat in the bishop's chair and just, like, sat there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just see
what happens. Until it's, like, call security or something. That would have been hilarious.
That would have been so good. Sister Allison, you're in my seat. No, I'm not. You're actually in my seat.
Everybody's seat.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Do you ever have fantasies of people like all opposed, like people raising their hands and like really dramatic stuff happening in sacrament meeting that would never happen?
Oh, I have a story about that, actually.
Let's hear it. I want it.
Real live story. So
it's always secondhand, by the way. All of these stories are like,
no,
oh,
it's not. This one is my story. I swear to you, it happened to me. I was in, this was like our ward that we were in when we were very first married. And I was the like Relief Society chorister or something, like some bullshit calling that they give new converts. And I loved that calling so, so much. And we didn't have kids yet or anything. And they wanted to give me a new calling. They wanted me to be like the six-year-old primary teacher or something like that. And I was devastated. I was heartbroken. Like, I didn't feel right. I didn't think it was from the spirit. I just knew it was like wrong and I did not want to do it. So in sacrament meeting, and I told the bishop this, I was like, I don't feel right about this, but I'll, you know, if you've prayed about it and you think that it's right, then I'm saying yes. So then in sacrament meeting, they announced it and they did the all oppose, you know, all sustain, and everybody raises their hands and they have you stand up, you know, when they do this. And I'm standing there sort of like in the middle set of pews kind of in the middle of those, so everybody can see me. And I am like sobbing. I am like racked with tears, sobbing. And my arms are folded and they're like, "Oh, you know, I'll sustain Sister Allison for this calling and any opposed." And I had my arms folded and I swear I raised my little hand. Like, so like nobody else could see it, but it was like, I do not think this is right. And later afterwards, the bishop like pulled me aside and he's like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, no, I'm not okay. I don't want to do this. And it's just teaching 6-year-olds. Like, I don't know what my problem was. Okay, hang on. I have to jump in here and explain myself a little bit, because I feel like if I tell you this story that I stood up in sacrament meeting and cried because I was going to have to go into primary, it just makes me sound like kind of a weirdo. So I want to explain myself a little bit. You see, I had just joined the church. I was very young. Even though I was newly married, I didn't have any friends that were Mormon. On top of that, I didn't even really know what primary was. I didn't grow up as a kid in the church. So to me, primary was like a cave. Like, what happens to people when they go to primary? You never see them anymore. You don't understand what they do for 2 hours each Sunday. And then they come out of church looking like they've just been in a war. Like, and there's snot all in their hair, and their clothes are on in a weird way that they weren't when they came to church. And they just look tired and, you know, bags under their eyes. It kind of scared me. And I didn't know any of the primary songs, which for some reason was a huge deal to me to have to learn all new primary songs after I just learned all these new weird church songs. And being a Relief Society was like my tribe. I finally got to the place where I understood it and I was starting to make friends and I started to feel like I actually fit in. And the idea of leaving that and leaving those people that I get to see every single week and going into this place where I was surrounded by new people and children, which I didn't really want any part of at that time, it just really scared me. I think it kind of made me feel like they wanted me to be a mom right away, or I don't know, like it didn't make sense to me. It almost felt to me like they thought that my place was in primary. And, well, I really wanted to decide where my place was. And I felt like my place was with these other women that I had grown to love and who I felt like understood me. And so that's why I really freaked out. And I did. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. It was probably in my top 5 most embarrassing stories. Maybe you'll get to hear the other 4 some other time. They're pretty great. But anyway, he was like, "Okay, well, we won't give you the calling then. You can keep being Relief Society chorister. That's fine."
Right, sticking it to the chaos.
A good ending to the story. My heart was breaking. I wanted to fight somebody.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
By the way, talking about getting callings, I was the activities director of my singles ward for a couple of years because I'm like so zany and outgoing. And we would go to the bishop's council, right? And when they would list out names for people to get a calling, I was so amazed because I thought that you came with a small group of names and then you prayed about it. And then the best person was the person that was going to be called. But it was like a laundry list. It was like, "Okay, how about him?" And then the bishop's like, "No, he can't do it. It won't expand. How about this guy? How about this guy? Yeah, let's call him." Like, it was so non-spiritual, practical, straightforward. It was something I set up on my shelf for a long time because I was like, I thought this was supposed to be a lot more like hippy dippy. Like, let's pray about it and see how we feel.
Well, being in those meetings, there's a cliche that we used to throw around. This is even when I was a believer, it goes from inspiration to desperation. So you just start to, you're like, we need Collingsfields. Let's just get whoever will take it.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Hey, I think I'm, unless anybody else has anything they want to talk about.
Yeah, we're at 117.
Yeah, so, I think that's a good amount of time.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I feel good. Thank you, guys.
And this has been amazing. So here's what to expect. In about half an hour, you're going to have like this sinking feeling of regret. Like, oh my God, I was horrible. But don't listen to it.
Okay.
You were awesome. And
it was pretty good. I don't even think I'm going to get that. And I get that most of the time.
My husband had some secondhand anxiety for me all day today. So, but I feel really good. It could be the fact that I had 3 drinks before we started talking.
Until it stops helping and then it gets weird. But
yeah.
Does your husband listen?
Yes, he does. He listens more than me. Well, he bikes to work every day, so like he has a lot more time to listen to podcasts. So he's super hot for infants.
What's his name?
His name is Chad.
Chad, we freaking love you, man.
Here, hold on. Have him come over. Come here, Chad. He just came back from bowling with his boss.
I love you guys too, you freaking sons of perdition. You love
me. Chad, that's awesome, man.
Hey, Chad. Wait, okay, so let me just get your I did want to ask what question did we have that was more directed towards Chad? It was like, did you join why did you join the church?
Were you chasing a piece of ass or did you really believe?
Right.
He's looking at it right now as he's thinking about it. Choose your words wisely, buddy.
You know, it's funny because on our way out of the church, it was like you start at the base and then you start whittling down to like the small little things that are holding you in. And I think that was like one of the last things where it was like Chad from, I don't know, when was that? 2008?
Yeah.
When I joined. Mm-hmm. I had myself convinced that it was like, oh yeah, of course, this is just my thing. I'm just, you know, I'm going to go be a good Mormon. And Wendy is secondary, which sounds totally horrible now that I just said that. But by the end, it was like, yeah, I pretty much did it just for Wendy.
Right before he joined the church, his aunt or his mom or somebody sent him a website that was like, before you join this religion, you should look at this. This is really problematic and we really care about you and we don't want you to do this. And I'm like reading through all this stuff with him. Like you have to physically like cut your head off and rip your bowels out in the temple. And I'm like, that's not true. That's bullshit. That's just ex-Mormon propaganda nonsense. But oh, it's true.
Yeah. We rip heads off all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to bear my testimony of the untruthfulness of the church, and I'm very glad that I'm not Mormon anymore.
My sister got lucky, married a yuppie, took him for all he was worth. Now she's a swinger, dating a singer. I can't decide which is worse. But not me, baby. I've got you to save me. Oh, you're so bad. Best thing I ever had in a world gone mad. You're so bad.
Hi, this is Anessa from Mesa, Arizona, and I am a feminist listening to Infants on Thrones while doing laundry. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsandthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
But not me, baby. I've got you to say.
I have to say one thing that I loved about your essay that kind of stood out to me, no pun intended, was the whole dick measuring thing. And I realized,
how did I know Allison would bring that up?
Of course I would. Come on. No, but I realized that is what Bob's cred scale was.
Uh-huh. Yes.
That was a dick measure.
Which, by the way, is totally sexist because
Michigan has
so many points on there when it's like bullshit. Missions for women do not hold the same cred in Mormonism as it does for men. So fuck you, Bob. Anyway, but isn't that
just because Mormonism is sexist? Like like women can never really represent the mean Mormon experience
Bob
cannot blame.
Mormon cred scale is going to be skewed towards men. Like the men's dicks have to be measured bigger because that's about Mormonism. That's
Bob is a product of his upbringing. Nobody can blame him for being sexist. That's how it is.
Right.
But yes, so I only scored like a six or something on the Mormon.
Oh yeah, I got a five. Yeah.
Because I didn't go to BYU, and I didn't – oh, it's ages, too, because I didn't go to BYU, I didn't go on a mission, and I don't have old kids because I'm not old.
Right. Oh, yeah, it is.
I'm a convert, so
– oh, yeah, you're – but right. think about your ex-Mormon cred, though. Your ex-Mormon cred is through the roof. I mean, you're running a panel on Infants on Thrones.
Still, yeah.
The premier secondary podcast in ex-Mormon.
Famous among dozens.
Dozens.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.